Think Paris. After the Eiffel Tower and the Champs-Élysées, what comes to mind? The croissant, the baguette, the bonbon? Food is certainly the most palatable expression of culture and the most easily shared. LA Times food critic Jonathan Gold has spent his career seeking out the best plates of authentic or reinterpreted culture. And Strange Champs asked him about food in translation.
So I was thinking, Jonathan, for people who love exploring other cultures, one of the most visceral ways to do that, of course, is to eat. And even if you can't afford plane fare, many of us who are lucky enough to live in medium or large cities can kind of take a little trip to another country just by hitting the right restaurant. But I think that maybe most of the time the food that we're eating has actually been subtly translated for North American appetites. Would you agree?
Of course it has, or at least in most of the country it has. I know in Madison, for example, and they have some Laotian restaurants that are fine, they're decent. But Laos is a poor country and it has a sort of cuisine of poverty. You know, they eat every leaf and every sort of herb, you know, tiny scraps of meat because they can't afford more. It's a specific kind of bitterness and of spiciness and of sort of herbaceous quality because that's what they can eat and that's what they can afford to eat. And so if they've, say, transplanted themselves to Madison in the middle of American abundance into a landscape where people perhaps can't tolerate bitter and spicy and herbaceous flavors like that, of course the flavors are going to change.
What about you live in L.A.? Do you find in a city like L.A. there's less of that translation going on?
I think there is. The reason L.A. is different from most cities in the country, I think, or maybe any city, is that, A, it's very spread out. B, we have enormous immigration. So Los Angeles has more Salvadorans than any city but San Salvador. There are more Koreans living here than there are anywhere outside of Korea. And the neighborhoods are insular enough that I find that a lot of those people in a lot of those restaurants are cooking for themselves rather than cooking for non-Korean or the non-Mexican that might be walking through the doors.
And how different does that make the food then?
It makes a huge difference, I think. In New York City, for example, which also has huge immigration, say you have a Korean restaurant that's in a Korean neighborhood. They're mostly cooking for Koreans, but still they take the subway every day like everybody else. And they're always rubbing shoulders with people who aren't Korean. And as a result, they're probably thinking a lot harder about what non-Koreans might like to eat. Whereas here, they don't. You know, Mr. Kim goes into a restaurant, he wants to eat exactly what his mother used to make him on Thursday afternoons when he was growing up, and he's able to find that. And we're able to go into those restaurants and eat what Mr. Kim is eating.
What do you think are the most egregious sorts of mistranslations of food, that ethnic food that you find in North America? I mean, food that's kind of been dumbed down, essentially. I mean, I think of, I don't know, that gloppy marinara sauce you find in Italian-American restaurants.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of the Olive Garden. But in a way, Americanization of foreign foods is legitimate in its own way. Cuisine is never stable. It's never fixed. It's always changing. And the ideas of what are authentic are always changing.
I mean, we're sort of assuming in this maybe kind of snobbish way that Americanized food automatically means it's not as good. It's not the authentic, real thing. It's inferior. It's been dumbed down. But sometimes, surely, an Americanized version of something actually takes on a life of its own and becomes good.
Oh, of course. Things are authentic to regions. One of the things that I write about a lot is Mexican food in Southern California. We've always had like a substantial, you know, Spanish-American or Mexican-American or plain Mexican community. And there are the sort of foods that people describe eating in the ranchos in the 19th century that you can still go into some restaurants here and find, you know, the beans cooked a certain way, the marinated and grilled meats, the chicharrones. And there's a well-developed sort of Chicano cuisine is what people grew up on. And then there's the second set of immigration, they identify with their village in Michoacán or coming from Guadalajara or coming from Zacatecas or coming from Oaxaca. Because there is this sort of quote-unquote authentic or more specifically regional food, that a lot of people who are sort of in the second stage of Los Angeles connoisseurship tend to dismiss the older places as inauthentic. And in fact, it's authentic Los Angeles, California cooking. It's just not authentic Zacatecas-style cooking.
Are there any cases where an ethnic food has been Americanized and then returned to its place of origin and gotten popular there?
It happens all the time in Korean cooking, for example. For example, there's a kind of tofu stew called sundobu, which is a kind of jjigae or soupy stew or soupy or stewy soup that has lots of chilies and usually sort of a fish broth and then freshly made tofu, and it's served at the table. And it's sort of always been a dish here, but then it became faddish, a really popular dish in Los Angeles in the 80s, and it went back and it became a fad in Seoul. Mm. Even with Italian cooking, I think. I was with a chef friend, Nancy Silverton, about 22 years ago in Northern Italy. We went to this sort of horrible folkloric restaurant. Among the many bad desserts we had was something they called panna cotta. And you could have played highlight with this and you could have bounced it. It was a super ball of a dessert. But Nancy is the genius pastry chef of all pastry chefs. So when she got back to California, she tinkered with it. She tinkered with it. She took out most of the gelatin. And she figured a way to, like, just barely set the cream so it was, like, rich and trembling. She started serving it on her menu. And it spread as a fad first across California, then to New York. Then it came back in Italy. And panna cotta is a really popular dessert there. And Italians, of course, will tell you that they've always had panna cotta. But I can tell you, they didn't have good panna cotta. That was Nancy.
That's a great story. So then in the 90s, there was the fusion cuisine trend. Remember when the very first, say, French Asian or Californian Asian restaurants were coming about? But in the meantime, fusion's kind of gotten a bad rap somehow. Was there something chefs were getting wrong in those efforts, do you think?
Well, there are a couple stages of fusion. The first stage of fusion was Japanese chefs cooking French food. Then Wolfgang Puck, you know, probably the first celebrity chef in the country, opened a restaurant called Chinois where he cooked Chinese food a French way. It was funny. All of his Chinese chefs quit really quickly within the first month because they refused to cook their food in this crazy way. This Austrian chef cooking French food was telling them to do. But it became it became really popular, and the food was really tasty. Soon, the idea of fusion became, you know, a lot of chefs go to cooking school, they're reading cookbooks, they're looking at things, they see flavor principles, and they were doing things like making Thai noodles without actually having driven the 20 minutes to the restaurant that served actually a really good version of it. But what we're seeing now, I think it's exciting. I think it's the new big trend in American cuisine, which is chefs from mostly an Asian background, but occasionally from a Latin background, who are exquisitely trained in French cuisine, coming back and cooking their own food, the food of their heritage, the food they grew up eating, but informed by all the technique that they've gotten from working in French restaurants.
The message of what you've been saying is that that's kind of where it's all headed. We're going to have layer upon layer of translation, and things will have gone back and forth from one continent to another. In the end, we're going to wind up with this sort of global cuisine or mishmash, and it'll be hard even to decode the origins.
Oh, yeah. I mean, already there are these incredible triple carom shots that I just absolutely love. For example, the kind of taco that is the most popular in Los Angeles now is something called al pastor, which is pork usually that's highly seasoned and cooked on a spit. But al pastor comes from central Mexico, where there was a lot of immigration from the Middle East, especially Lebanon. And Al Pastor, of course, is their version of shawarma. Or there's this chain of incredibly popular seafood restaurants here that are Vietnamese shrimpers from Houston cooking Cajun-style seafood for a largely Cantonese teenage audience.
Hmm. And listening to you talk, I realize this is what you are. You're a food translator in a way yourself.
Well, thank you. It's what I try to do. If there's anything other than like describing food that I do, is try to get people to be a little less afraid of their neighbors.
Jonathan Gold is a restaurant critic for the LA Times, and he's the author of Counterintelligence, Where to Eat in the Real Los Angeles, and Strange Champs talked with him. You can hear the extended version of this interview and dig through our archives for a banquet of foodie fun on our website, ttbook.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.